Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Sumi Somaskander from the Global Story podcast, where we're asking how the US election could impact the war in Ukraine. With Kamala Harris and Donald Trump neck and neck in the polls, President Zelensky's campaign to ensure crucial funds don't run out is increasingly uncertain. So will the result in November change his nation's fate? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London with me, Sean Lay. Today we're going to hear about what it's like to do rehab in Singapore, a country known for its zero-tolerance approach to drugs. Also, the 23-year-old mountaineer who became the youngest woman to climb all 14 peaks over 8,000 metres. And the Hollywood legend Al Pacino talks to us about his career, becoming a father again in his 80s, and a near-death experience during the pandemic. All of that coming up in the next hour, but first to our top story this hour, and that is the letter that has been sent by the United States to Israel's government, giving it 30 days to dramatically improve humanitarian aid access in Gaza or face having some US military assistance cut off. Matthew Miller, who speaks for the US State Department, told a news conference that the Biden administration is asking Israel to adapt the way it prosecutes its war.
There are implications under US law, under policy, that I'm not going to speak to here, largely because we hope that Israel makes the changes that the secretary outlined in the letter. We have seen Israel make changes before, and when they make changes, humanitarian assistance can increase.
So was this letter from the State Department and the Defense Department meant to be made public, or was it leaked? The BBC's security correspondent in Washington, D.C. is Gordon Carrera.
Well, officially, it was a private communication that was made on Sunday by the US Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense to Israeli counterparts. But it has leaked within 2 days, and I think there might be some suspicion that that's not accidental. But officials here in Washington are saying that this isn't necessarily completely new, because back in the spring, they had similar concerns about problems with aid, humanitarian aid, getting into Gaza, and that they talked to the Israelis then. And in that case, there were changes, and the number of trucks going in increased to 300 to 400. But the concern in Washington is that that hasn't been sustained, and that's now fallen 50% from the peak, with September last month being the worst month for humanitarian aid deliveries. So they then wrote this letter to basically call for the Israelis to do more and to go back to the kind of levels and the kind of action that they'd managed in the spring. So with a 30-day timetable for possible implications. 30-day timetable also takes you beyond the US election, it's worth saying.
And what are those?
Biden would still be in office.
Indeed. What are those implications of if the 30-day deadline is not met to the satisfaction of the Americans?
Well, I think what's interesting is that we don't have any specifics about that. There is the possibility of a US military aid being restricted. But the specifics of what that might be, whether it would be automatic, how that would be determined, none of that is clear, nor is it clear that there are substantive discussions about that. When pressed about it at the briefing, US State Department officials have said they won't get into the kind of discussion of either specifics or any Israeli response so far. And so it is quite unclear what might happen.
And yet the list that's in the letter, the requirements for the Israelis to carry out, are not permissive. They don't give much wiggle room, do they? They're pretty prescriptive. I mean, to give some examples, a minimum of 350 trucks per day to be allowed into Gaza, to keep all four existing crossings open and open a fifth, regular humanitarian pauses for the winter months, remove restrictions on the use of closed trucks and containers. I mean, that's pretty... There isn't much wiggle room.
No, you're right. I mean, it's a long list, and it's a very specific list about what the US wants to see happen. And I think that is a sign that they're not just after a token change, but something substantive, which they would like to see in response to this. I think that the question, though, about what will happen if those conditions and all of those conditions aren't met, that is still a little bit less clear so far at this point. And we'd have to see, I suppose, in 30 days, what then the consequences might be if there isn't movement on this.
Can this be regarded in any way as a shift in the American position?
I think it is noticeable that you've got this happening and you've also got the US offering a missile defence system to Israel at the same time. And you could see those, you know, you might see those as being in contradiction to each other, one being tougher on Israel, the other offering it something. But I think it's part of a kind of multifaceted US response in which it is wanting to support Israel in certain activities, including its defence against Iran, and is more supportive of its actions against Hezbollah in Lebanon, but actually more worried in Washington about what Israel is doing in Gaza and the humanitarian situation there and the failure because of both Hamas and Israel to reach a ceasefire agreement in Gaza. So I think you can see a multi-layered approach, if you like, to Israel from Washington at the moment.
Security correspondent Gordon Carrera. Brad Sherman is a Democratic congressman for Southern California, a senior member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. When he spoke to NewsHour, I suggested to him it was hard to read this other than as a warning to Prime Minister Netanyahu.
I don't see it as quite that strong. A lot of it relates to what has to happen before winter. We haven't even had Halloween yet. Winter's a ways away. Ultimately, Israel is going to have to allow preparations for winter for the Gaza population.
In terms of what is said, though, it's very specific. It expresses the deep concern of the American administration, the deteriorating humanitarian situation, the need for urgent steps, the need to reverse a negative trend, which it says meant in September the Israelis prevented or delayed approximately 90% of the humanitarian movements between northern and southern Gaza in September.
Well, that's between the two areas. Many trucks enter just the south or enter just the north. Intra-Gaza transportation between the two areas is I think, a smaller issue. But ultimately, the United States is pressing Israel to give a high priority to the Gaza population. And I think that makes sense. At the same time, the Gaza population cannot be safe unless Hamas departs. I'm not one that says that I expect them to surrender, but they can leave the area. There are empty apartment units in Tehran because the government of Iran has executed so many of its citizens.
Okay, but let's just focus, if we may, on what Israel is doing and its reaction to this letter. We were hoping to speak to an Israeli government spokesperson. Indeed, until half an hour before we came on air, they had agreed to take part in the program. Then they told us they wouldn't be available. But my colleague Jamie Kumarasamy has spoken to Simcha Rothman, who is an Israeli politician whose religious Zionism party is part of Prime Minister Netanyahu's ruling coalition. He says this letter is a mistake.
I have to say, I think there is a big problem of moral clarity. It ignores that it's a known fact that humanitarian aid, and by the way, humanitarian aid that entered Gaza is way more the international standard and demand. It's not true that there is no food in Gaza. It's just not true. But it ignores the more basic reality. And the basic reality is that humanitarian aid that gets to Gaza is directly serving Hamas to take over Gaza, to use it as a pressure on the population. Many trucks of humanitarian aid goes directly to Hamas, helping them build and recruit more terrorists, use the money, they're selling it, and they use the money. Is it the moral thing for the population in Gaza to give more power to Hamas? How is it a moral thing to do?
Listening to that, as I'm still with us, is Brad Sherman, U.S. Congressman. Do you share Mr. Rothman's concern? Is that a legitimate point of view, do you think?
Well, he should be concerned that Hamas is stealing the aid, selling it, and using the money to support terrorism.
But should America be concerned?
Of course we should be concerned about how our aid is being stolen by Hamas. It is incumbent on the aid distribution groups, including the UN, to make sure that the trucks don't just go in and be turned over to Hamas, but rather that the aid groups supervise the distribution to those who really need it.
But so, you know what the implication of this letter is, that actually the Israelis, who after all are the power on the ground, are not permitting that to happen. You can't get away from this.
Exaggerating that on power on the ground. Israel has maybe 2,000 soldiers on the ground in Gaza. That's very, very few. The Chicago Police Department has 11,000 officers.
Yeah, it's not quite the same comparison, though, is it? Because the circumstances are different.
Yes, it proves to control Gaza, to really be in control of Gaza, Israel would need 30 or 40,000.
Okay, well, let's deal with the specifics of the letter then. The amount of aid delivered has dropped by more than 50%, the letter says, since the assurances given in March and a letter from April from the Israeli government, which in its words brought important improvements in the provision of humanitarian aid. And the spokesperson for the State Department told journalists tonight there needs to be a dramatic improvement in the amount of aid that Israel is permitting to get to people in Gaza.
I think it's in Israel's interest to literally flood Gaza with so much food that these questions aren't raised, and so that food is being smuggled out of Gaza, probably by Hamas, and sold on the black market. That's how much food ought to get in order to deal with Israel's biggest problem, which is publicity and questioning as to whether...
You understand why that publicity and questioning happens. It happens not least because Israel does not permit anyone else to go in and monitor what it is doing and what is happening, whether by its intention or by accident.
Well, it's a war zone, and if any journalist in the area gets hurt or killed, Israel is blamed, again by BBC claiming that Israel is in control of Gaza when obviously Israel is not. Israel has some forces on the ground in Gaza. There are 30,000 Hamas gunmen and 2,000 Israeli soldiers.
Okay, if the Israeli government declines to meet, as I've already said in my interview with Gordon Crowe, a very prescriptive list of requirements, would you accept that that would justify the United States, under American law, withholding some arms supplies to the Israelis?
I can't imagine that it's going to come to that. I'm confident that this will be worked out. Israel is America's friend in the Middle East. We've had some differences in prioritization, and I'm very sure that.
Then what is the point of the letter if it is a letter with no sanctions?
The point of the letter is between friends, a list of items for us to negotiate with Israel that I believe will reach an agreement on such issues as where the Gaza population will be as we move into winter, how many aid trucks are going in, how many to the north, how many to the south. The United States is focused on this aid, and we'll be pushing Israel in that direction. And I'm very sure that this will be worked out, especially when the letter is focused so much on winter, and this is the fall.
Congressman Brad Sherman, a member of President Joe Biden's Democratic Party. More on this developing story on our website, bbc.com. But you are listening to the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour. Coming up, the 23-year-old climber who's become the youngest woman to conquer all 14 of the world's 8,000-metre-plus peaks.
To recover from a mountain when you climb without oxygen on an 8,000-metre peak, it takes a longer time because you not only have to recover physically but also mentally. You lose a lot of brain cells when you're climbing without oxygen. So things like memory loss is very common. Forgetting where my keys are on my wallet is happening a lot at the moment.
Our main story this hour. The United States has written to Israel's government, giving it 30 days to boost humanitarian aid access in Gaza or face cuts in US military support. And the European Union Energy Commissioner has criticised EU countries that continue to rely on Russian gas after the bloc saw a recent rise in imports. This is Sean Lay with NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. When it comes to drugs, many countries say they have a policy of zero tolerance. In Singapore, they mean it. Smuggling risks the death penalty. Personal use of any illegal narcotic, puffing on a marijuana cigarette, say, is likely to lead to compulsory rehab. Linda Presley was given access to the state's austere drug rehabilitation centre, where users often spend months.
Singapore's Drug Rehabilitation Centre, or DRC, is located in a huge complex in the east of the island. There's no private residential drug rehab facility in Singapore, so no swanning around in fluffy bathrobes with accommodation provided in cosy ensuite bedrooms. When drug users are picked up, they may spend months here.
I'm Ravin Singh. I'm the second superintendent of Institution S1, which is primarily for first and second time drug abusers. There are about 500 or so of them.
Superintendent Singh of Singapore's prison service shows us around. He takes us into an unoccupied cell that usually accommodates seven or eight men. At the back, there are two squat toilets and a shower behind a waist-high wall. There are mounted cameras in the ceiling.
There are no beds.
There are no beds in any of our prisons, only in our medical wards.
But this is drug rehabilitation. It's not prison.
So whilst it is rehabilitation, it is still a very deterrent regime. So while we rehabilitate you, we also want you to remember that it's not offence that you should repeat.
And you come into... this is effectively a prison, right?
Well, it looks like a prison, but like I said, you'll see that the inmates are a bit more free-roaming. Their movements are not so tightly controlled.
And nor will a stay at the DRC get you a criminal record. A recognition that drug users aren't simply bad people. They often need rehabilitation. At the DRC, inmates spend up to 6 hours a day in a classroom on psychology-based courses.
My name is Lau Kuan Lee. I'm a Deputy Director for Correctional Rehabilitation Services. So the aim is to motivate inmates to want to change. In this case, is to want to stay away from drugs, to renew their lives without drugs, and to address a negative attitudes, negative thinking regarding drug use.
Okay, should we go in?
Yes.
During the exercise, I try to focus on my tapping, but...
Inside the bright, spacious room, there's a mindfulness session in progress. Around 15 men sit in a horseshoe around a course leader.
What is important here is being mindful of your present moment. What are you?
The prison authorities have selected two inmates to speak to us. They're not cannabis smokers. They both have a history of methamphetamine use. Meth is a powerful, synthetic, highly addictive stimulant, and the most commonly abused drug in Singapore. And for a young man I'll call Jack, reeling from a romantic breakup earlier this year, his drug use became more than a little problematic.
I was in public. I hadn't eaten or slept in 4 days. I was basically having a psychosis episode, and the police were informed. During my time of use, I never thought it would ever happen to me.
This is Jack's second time in the DRC. He was here before in 2021.
The first time was, I'm never coming back to this hellhole. This time I felt like, because of the circumstance of how I was caught this time around, I felt that it was a big eye-opener.
Scary, right?
Scary. Very scary. Coming back here, although being away from family, being away from friends is painful, right? Coming back here, I really needed to understand, to learn, to live a better life. So I cannot say that I will not come back, but I will do whatever it takes to stay on this journey of sobriety.
There's more from Linda Presley in Singapore in assignment on the BBC World Service. If you want to hear both parts of her report, just download the podcast, the documentary. Research by the BBC has found that burning household rubbish is the filthiest form of generating energy in the UK. Incinerators, known in the trade as waste energy plants, have been touted as a greener alternative to landfill, that's burying the waste underground. The BBC examined 5 years of figures. They reveal that burning waste produces the same amount of greenhouse gases per unit of energy as coal power. Next year in Italy, Rome will begin constructing a $1 billion incinerator to try to solve its own household waste crisis. A big mistake, says Marielle Villaya from the Global Alliance for Incinerator Alternatives.
Burning waste is a very dirty source of energy. It produces pollution, air pollution containing heavy metals, dioxins, furans, particulate matter that, of course, impact all the population around the incinerator and beyond. It's also producing a great amount of greenhouse gas emissions, CO2, so it's a net contributor to climate change. And on top of that, it's a very expensive technology. It's expensive to be built and it's expensive to be maintained because incinerators will be established in a way with a municipality with a contract that is typically called put or pay, by which the municipality will be obliged to give waste to this incinerator for 20 or 30 years. And in this sense, this municipality will not be able to reduce any waste. So any sustainability policies that they want to implement will be automatically jeopardized. Now, the problem is that most of the waste that goes into this incinerator, in most cases, is recyclable or compostable. That is cardboard, organic waste, other materials that could be recovered, that we could put back into the economy or in the society. And they are wasted and they are lost forever.
I'm confused, and lots of people listening will be confused, because in recent years we've been told that this was virtually a green way of actually getting rid of our waste and generating energy, much better than dumping it in the ground. One example of which is what's happening in Rome at the moment, where they're about to spend $1 billion on a new rubbish incinerator, and they say that it will burn about 600,000 tonnes of waste a year, but generate enough energy to power 200,000 homes. Are they wrong?
The waste that this incinerator will be burning is recyclable waste and is compostable waste. And this, if we want to have a chance to live in a sustainable planet, if we want to have a chance to meet the climate targets that Italy is committed to, they should be recovering these materials and they should be looking at other sources of energy that will be much greener and much more sustainable. So the heating source for the households, definitely they need to be looking at other sources, because burning recyclable materials for this amount of energy is really not a good balance in the sustainability books.
What about those plastics that can't be recycled? Would you go so far as to say, as I've heard some experts say today, that look, if you have the alternative of burning the plastic or sticking it in the ground and burying it, it would be better to bury it in the ground, or at least it would be the least worst option?
Exactly. That is the recent research, what it's saying. Plastic contains a lot of toxic components and burning it precisely makes a lot of air pollution that goes into the environment. It would be a lot more environmentally friendly to bury it in a place that it doesn't produce more contamination rather than burning it, which will effectively produce a landfill in the sky. It will create the greenhouse gas emissions and all the pollution that eventually we will all breathe.
That's Marielle Villaya from the Global Alliance for Incinerator Alternatives, talking to me a little earlier here on BBC NewsHour.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast, where we're asking how the U.S. election could impact the war in Ukraine. With Kamala Harris and Donald Trump neck and neck in the polls, President Zelensky's campaign to ensure crucial funds don't run out is increasingly uncertain. So will the result in November change his nation's fate? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Google is going nuclear. It's placed an order for several small reactors. The reason? data centers, which power artificial intelligence, AI, are relentlessly energy hungry. Rory Monaghan, Professor of Energy Systems Engineering at the University of Galway in Ireland, has been speaking about Google's energy needs to Tim Franks.
If you were to compare, for example, a ChatGPT query with a Google query, you'd be looking at roughly a 10 times increase in power demand to perform one query. Now, not every data center into the future is purely going to be handling generative AI queries, but this 10 times difference, even allowing for some improvements in efficiency in the AI processes going forward, there's still going to be an appreciable increase in the amount of energy required for AI-enabled data centers compared to the ones that we operate now.
I guess one obvious source that you might imagine that these tech companies could reach for would be renewable power. Why not renewable and why nuclear, do you think?
I guess the issue here is scale and speed. The speed that generative AI has caught on and the speed that is expected to grow into the future is faster than what we've seen in the past. And then there's this massively increased energy demand that is going to be needed to fuel it. In many countries where we have renewable energy being brought online, we're nearly running to keep up with increases in demand. One of the drivers of that demand would be data centers. So I think with these announcements about the small nuclear reactors, what they're trying to do there is to get ahead of this running to keep up and try and build something large scale quickly.
Is there anything in the argument that although nuclear power is controversial, there are lots of people who do see it as being a good intermediate way, at the very least, of trying to wean us off our need for fossil fuels, that when you get these tech giants coming into the market and saying, right, we're going to buy up capacity or encourage new capacity to be built, which we will then have first dibs on, that actually it means that there's less capacity for the rest of us.
This is probably the crux of it. Certainly what we see in countries that are trying to build out renewables, we're really building up renewables and we're just about keeping pace with increases in demand. And a big portion of that demand growth is data centers. When we're looking at this particular deal, what makes this interesting is the fact that the data centers here are promoting a new technology. It's giving an off-taker to electricity for a new technology that it might not have had. So there are some effects down the line here that might be difficult to predict, in that this could help a new zero carbon, stable, predictable type of electricity generation come to market faster than it would have in the absence of this data center demand. This is really where the argument is. With the growth in data center demand, are we reducing the supply available for everyone else, or are we in fact promoting opportunities for new technologies to get to market?
Professor Roy Monaghan talking with Tim Franks. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Sean Lay. Let's return to our top story this hour. The US demand that Israel improves humanitarian access to Gaza or risks cuts to the military assistance America provides. According to the Hamas-run health ministry, more than 42,000 people have been killed and 95,000 injured since Israel began its war against Hamas in Gaza. Khalid, a father of five children, and Aya, a law graduate in her 20s, have spent the last year documenting their struggle to survive. BBC Eye's Lara El-Ghabali has their story.
On a table in his apartment, Khalid is dressing the wounds of a young boy.
When the war started, I opened a medical center in my house. I'm a physiotherapist, not really a doctor. This was a big change for me.
Khalid lives in Jabalia, in northern Gaza, one of the areas worst affected by the war. A week into the war in October 2023, the Israeli army told people to evacuate the area and head south. Khalid's four-year-old daughter, Halum, says she doesn't want to leave. Because, she adds, I'm scared of the missiles. With hospitals stretched, Khalid feels that he has to stay and help.
Today I dealt with a child. He was still breathing. If we'd had the means, we would have operated on his brain because he had a hemorrhage. but unfortunately, we had to let him die. There was nothing we could do for him.
Aya was also in northern Gaza, but as the fighting got closer, she moved with her parents and seven siblings to the center.
I came to this shelter school in October. The school seems like the safest place to be at the moment.
In Gaza, nowhere is safe for long. Khaled watches as his son, Hamoud, pretends to perform surgery on a tiny doll. She's injured, he says. Rubble fell on her.
When I see them like this, my heart breaks. These are not games children should play.
Aya and her family have had to move south to Rafah, where a million people are sheltering.
We're literally living like animals here. We've just received news that our house was destroyed. What do you mean I won't go back to my home, my bed, my room, or anything?
By April, food is running dangerously low. Airplanes begin dropping aid.
The amount of aid that falls is very, very small.
With no food, Khaled's family have to resort to desperate measures. Khaled's children are eating raw weeds.
We eat things knowing that they might poison us, but we do it because there is no alternative.
In June, Aya receives some devastating news.
I lost one of my ankles right now.
She posts a video to social media, speaking English this time, so the world can hear.
No one cares about us. We lost our families, our friends. No one cares about this.
Lara El-Ghabali from BBCI reporting. In Lebanon, meanwhile, it's now known that 24 people were killed in an airstrike on Monday in a Christian area in the north of the country. Reports say the majority of those who died are women and children. The UN's Human Rights Office has called for an investigation, saying it raised real concerns about international humanitarian law. These residents blamed Hezbollah for turning them into a target.
It dragged Lebanon into war, and this war has no end. Death only brings more death. It's not going to end, so better to have peace. For us in our village, maybe we won't welcome any more people. And villagers who have taken in displaced people, I think they will ask them to leave.
May God not grant them success. They dragged us into this war, and it is never ending. It's unfair. We have children who are living this war. Whom do I blame? Who will I blame except Hezbollah?
Well, meanwhile, that group's deputy leader, Naim Qassem, released a video message today. He claimed Hezbollah has the capacity to hit anywhere in Israel, despite the attacks upon it, but that they were open to a ceasefire. Listening to his speech, the BBC's Jonathan Head in the Lebanese capital, Beirut.
Well, I think his message was aimed at two audiences. I mean, obviously, he wanted to let the world know, and Israel in particular, that Hezbollah is still in the game. You know, there were lots of messages to Israel, lots of threats. We can still hit you. There was this reference to a ceasefire as a way out. But then he also said you cannot separate Palestine from Lebanon. In other words, you cannot separate Hamas and Hezbollah. And that's been the sticking point all along. Hezbollah started this particular fight with Israel in solidarity with Hamas. And it people have wondered whether, given the enormous punishment it's taken in the last 3 weeks, whether it might be willing to do a separate ceasefire with Israel. We don't know if Israel's willing either, but by tying it to Hamas, and obviously Israel has a lot of unfinished business with Hamas at the moment, it means that whatever talk of a ceasefire he raised isn't realistic at the moment. But there was also a message to the people of Lebanon. Many people are very, very angry with Hezbollah, as well as Israel, for dragging them into this war. Most Lebanese people are not supporters of Hezbollah, even though it's a very powerful entity here. And he pleaded for unity and patience. And he put Hezbollah forward as the champion of the defense against Israel. He warned that Israel would remake Lebanon and the Middle East in its own fashion if Hezbollah was destroyed, and pleaded with people to be patient, promising that their houses would be rebuilt even better than before, made a kind of plea for national unity. National unity is a pretty elusive thing in Lebanon. I'm not sure how successful he will be. There's an enormous weariness here about the scale of suffering and the humanitarian needs that have been pushed by this war.
And yet striking to hear those residents, don't know if they're a representative sample, but nonetheless a couple of residents from the area bombed yesterday saying not so much we're angry with Israel bombing us as we're angry with Hezbollah for making us targets for Israel to bomb.
I think that's not an uncommon sentiment, and it's a real problem because it means that one of the consequences of this conflict, even if Israel finishes its operations, is it could really inflame sectarian tensions in Lebanon. You've got huge numbers of people on the move, massive numbers. It's an enormous strain on societies to have to accommodate them. The state is very weak. It can't provide much help. It does seem that the village that was attacked yesterday by Israel, this village called Aitu, although it's a Maronite Christian village, had seen a lot of displaced people coming out from the Shiite south, from the Hezbollah area, to find shelter there. A lot of people have left Aitu and emigrated to the United States, so there were houses available. And it seems as though Israel saw a target in one of those groups. And the bomb that was fired completely destroyed the house where these displaced people were. I mean, most of the victims, as far as we can tell, are children, older women, men who don't look like combatants. But clearly Israel believed there was somebody worth targeting there. And the local residents do say that, you know, that Hezbollah brings this to us. But it's creating a real problem because now more and more Lebanese are wary of helping out displaced people for fear that, particularly if they've come from a Shiite area, they might be bringing someone who will be a target for Israel, which will then bring horrible destruction onto their communities. It's just sowing a whole lot more communal mistrust and unease in this already very unsettled country.
Jonathan Head speaking to NewsHour from Beirut. Now, in the close to 1,000 days since Russia launched its attempted invasion, the Ukrainians have consistently demanded reinforcement for air defences from their allies. To combat the almost nightly bombardment by drones, teams of volunteers roam the countryside. One called themselves the Witches of Baucha. The BBC's Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford went to that city to join them on their late-night patrol.
When Russian drones swarm over Kyiv, the sound is unmistakable, and it's nerve-wracking. Then, usually, comes the boom of Ukraine's air defences. The number of drones is increasing. So, one night, we went on patrol with a team of volunteers who are helping the Air Force to protect the skies in the Bucha region, just outside the capital.
There is a total of 25 drones at the moment over Ukraine.
So the mobile air defence team have just stopped their car ahead of us, about 200 metres. We just got out. We're walking through the middle of a pitch black field, up a dirt track towards them where they're getting into position.
The unit call themselves the Witches of Bucha because, with one exception, they're women, stepping up now that so many men have been deployed to the front lines. Ukraine is short of weapons too. The machine guns that the witches are assembling were made in 1939. They have to pour in bottled water as a coolant.
Максимально в темноті, щоб не виявляти позиції. Це раз. Він може спікірувати на світло.
So Valentina's saying that the drones could see the light and could respond to that. They don't know how the drones are going to behave. So they're saying we need to work in the dark, essentially.
Of course, it's nervous work because we need to be focused to react to the slightest sound.
Valentina is a vet. The commander, Yulia, has a day job as a manicurist. Her team have downed 3 drones so far. She says there are more in the air these days. And when I ask why, she shrugs. I think they want to kill us. The women joke a lot here, but they're all from Bucha. And at the start of the all-out invasion, they lived under occupation when Russian forces killed and brutalize civilians here. Anya is an office manager who tells me how she felt totally useless during the occupation, unable to defend her family. And that was terrifying. And this is Ina. She's a maths teacher.
You cry and suffer for the people who are no longer here, those taken by the stupid war. Then they were recruiting women here, and I tried it and didn't fall apart.
Back at base camp, Valentina stokes the fire in a hut as rain hammers down on the roof. She's on patrol duty, waiting for the next air raid. She tells me the men who used to defend the skies here are now in Pokrovsk in the east, where the fighting against Russia is fiercest. So we try to smile and stay cheerful, she says. But we're just waiting for them to come back alive.
Sarah Rainsford with the Ukrainian women volunteers who scan the night skies above their city in Ukraine. This is NewsHour from the BBC World Service. A reminder of our top story this hour. The United States has written to Israel's government, giving it 30 days to boost humanitarian aid access in Gaza or face cuts in US military support. Democratic Congressman Brad Sherman told NewsHour he didn't think the US would ever stop supplying Israel with arms, but that it was important to get more aid in.
I think it's in Israel's interest to literally flood Gaza with so much food that these questions aren't raised. And so that food is being smuggled out of Gaza, probably by Hamas, and sold on the black market. That's how much food ought to get in order to deal with Israel's biggest problem, which is publicity and questioning.
Our other headline, the European Union Energy Commissioner has criticized EU countries that continue to rely on Russian gas after the bloc saw a recent rise in imports. This is NewsHour with Sean Lay, live from London. Youth is wasted on the young, so goes an old proverb. It certainly doesn't apply to the mountaineer Adriana Brownlee. In the last 3 years, she's climbed all 14 of the world's highest peaks, and at the age of 23, she's the youngest woman to ever do so. She's currently in Nepal, recovering from the last of them, which was in China, and she spoke to the BBC's Sarah Montague.
Shisha Pangma was an absolutely incredible climb, but it was very difficult. This time I chose to climb without supplementary oxygen. So the summit push, which was 1,000 meters of ascent, it was very challenging. It was cold. When you're climbing without oxygen, your mind doesn't think clearly. So you're totally self-sufficient. I had the support of my Sherpa guide as well. But it's all about looking after your body, trying not to get frostbite, trying to keep one foot in front of the other. But it was all worth it in the end to be able to summit Shisha Pangma and complete my 14 peaks.
Where are the 14 peaks over 8,000 meters? I mean, you're in Kathmandu now. Are they all in the Nepalese mountain range?
So there are 8 in Nepal, there are 5 in Pakistan, and then the rest are in Tibet and China.
Which was the hardest?
The hardest of the 14 was probably Nanga Parbat for me. We have ropes and we have some support there to climb it, but with a big backpack on of about 10 to 15 kilos and massive, ginormous 8,000 meter boots on and crampons, it's a very technical climb. So that was definitely the hardest.
There is, rather unusually, someone else who's managed this feat, isn't there, just this week?
Yes, there's a few others that also completed their 14 peaks. I was climbing with Nima Rinji, who's a Sherpa. He was the youngest ever to do it as well.
When you came down from the 14th, not even a week ago, how long does recovery take?
To recover from a mountain when you climb without oxygen on an 8,000 meter peaks, it takes a longer time because you not only have to recover physically, but also mentally. You lose a lot of brain cells when you're climbing without oxygen. So things like memory loss is very common. Forgetting where my keys are on my wallet is happening a lot at the moment. So it'll take about 1 or 2 months to start to recover. And also hunger is a big thing. You cannot stop eating after an 8,000 meter peak. So hopefully that stops soon.
You must have had to be incredibly fit.
Yeah, you definitely have to have a very high fitness level in terms of physically. And so it was training every single day, especially before Everest, before the start of the project. I trained probably for about 4 years, 6 days a week, 3 to 4 hours a day, because I knew that I had to be as fit as possible on the summit of those mountains, because it's all about safety. And if you're fit and you're ready to go, then you've ticked one of those boxes and the things that you can control. And the mountains, there are many things that you can't control, like avalanche, but fitness is one of them. So yeah, a lot of training.
Where did all this start, Adriana?
Yeah, it's a great question. So it all started actually when I was about 8 years old. So my father was the one who loved to do mountaineering, and he was always climbing. And so when he came back home from his expeditions, to me, he was like the most incredible human being. And I wanted to replicate that in my life. And so from 8 years old, I wrote a letter to myself at primary school saying that I want to climb Everest and I want to inspire other people and I want to be the youngest to do it. So 12 years later, I summited Everest. It was my obsession for all those 12 years. And then upon summiting Everest, I decided to continue with the 14 Peaks Challenge and summit the 13 others. And so here I am today.
Many congratulations to Adriana Brownlee talking to Sarah Montague. And this is NewsHour from the BBC. Thanks for your company.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story Podcast, where we're asking how the U.S. election could impact the war in Ukraine. With Kamala Harris and Donald Trump neck and neck in the polls, President Zelensky's campaign to ensure crucial funds don't run out is increasingly uncertain. So will the result in November change his nation's fate? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.